You're listening to LawPod UK. It's a podcast that discusses developments across all aspects of civil and public law in the United Kingdom. All the comments are current at the time of podcast publication. LawPod UK is produced by the barristers at 1 Crown Office Row and is presented by Rosalind English.
Earlier this week, the Supreme Court handed down judgment in a case concerning the liability of the NHS for the actions of non-medical staff. The case is called Darnley and Croydon Health Services NHS Trust, better known as the Mayday Hospital in Croydon. Full disclosure here, I worked on the comparative law brief for the Respondent Hospitals team, led by Philip Havers QC. I looked at similar cases all over the world, the US, Canada, South Africa, Israel, Japan, and so on. But all to no avail, because the hospital lost in the end. Owen Thomas QC has written on the case for our blog and has kindly agreed to discuss it with me. Owen, welcome to LawPod UK.
Thank you.
Perhaps you could just set out the facts of the case for us. They're pretty straightforward, aren't they?
Yes. So Mr. Darnley, the claimant, was taken to the accident and emergency department at the Mayday Hospital by a friend, having been assaulted earlier that day and suffering from a head injury. They approached the receptionist at the A&E department and were told that he would have to wait for about 4 to 5 hours before being seen. His friend explained to the receptionist that he could not wait that long because he was very unwell and that he was in fact worried he would collapse. The receptionist said that if he did collapse, then he would be treated as an emergency, but that otherwise they would have to wait. They both stayed in the hospital, but only for a short time, after which they left, at least in part, the judge found, because of what they were told about the length of the waiting time. He went to his mother's house. He did deteriorate there, and in fact, he collapsed. He was left suffering from serious brain damage, which had resulted in a severe left hemiplegia, so a serious injury. The remaining important facts are that the trial judge found that if he had been told that he would be seen within 30 minutes, he would probably have stayed and he would have been seen by someone before the time at which he left. He would have been admitted at that point or told to wait, and that it would have been during that period of waiting at the hospital that he in fact suffered his collapse. But he would have then been in hospital, he would have been transferred and treated sooner and made a near full recovery. So those were the facts.
Yes, and if we could just back up a bit, could you remind us of the head injury protocol in accident and emergency?
Yes, so it was common ground that the what patients who report a head injury to A&E receptionists should be told is that they would be seen within 30 minutes and triaged appropriately. In other words, they would then be assessed and a degree of priority would be assigned to that person's case depending on how severe a presentation they had. And that was accepted by the hospital. So in other words, it was accepted that he shouldn't have been told that he might have to wait for 4 to 5 hours. He should have been told that he would be seen within 30 minutes.
Despite the trial judge's findings on the facts, that court found for the defendant on liability. Why was that?
Yes. So the trial judge, even though he found that the claimant should not have been told that he had to wait for 4 to 5 hours, and he found that if he'd been told the correct information, he would have stayed and not suffered his severe injury, the judge found that there was no duty of care owed by the defendant to the claimant in these circumstances because, he said, receptionists in A&E departments are not under a duty to guard patients against injuries caused by a failure by them to wait to be seen, even if that injury is foreseeable on the facts. So he found that the injury suffered was outside the scope of any duty of care, and he obviously found it to be very significant that this was a case where the claimant had decided to leave without telling anybody that he was going to leave.
And when this case went to the Court of Appeal, when the claimant appealed to the Court of Appeal, he lost there too, didn't he?
He did, and the Court of Appeal analysed this case as being one where they had to decide whether in a novel situation, so one not encountered before, the defendant owed a duty of care to the claimant, and the Court of Appeal found that applying the Caparo Industries approach to determining whether a duty of care arises on new facts, it was not appropriate to impose a duty of care on the hospital, and they found that there was no duty or no cause of action arose on the basis of incorrect information being given to the public by receptionist staff. They also found that it would not be fair, just and reasonable to impose on non-medical staff of A&E departments a duty not to provide inaccurate information. And they, in making that judgment, two points really supported their approach in finding that. First, that the chaos and difficulty of working in A&E and the difficulty of giving accurate information about waiting times. And second, a finding that the social and financial cost of imposing extra liabilities on NHS trusts was not desirable. And so for that reason, too, the Court of Appeal found that no duty of care arose.
Well, by the time it arrived in the Supreme Court, there was still no other case or precedent involving non-medical staff giving rise to a negligence claim, but the Supreme Court still found that this was not a new category of negligence. Do you agree with their approach?
Well, I think that it's certainly a very compressed passage of reasoning by the Supreme Court, in that they acknowledge that the question of whether a duty of care arises shouldn't be determined by reference to some unifying principle. It has to be determined by reference to whether the situation is one which has already been accepted as an established category of negligence. And if not, then application of the Caparo Industries test set down by Lord Bridge all the way back in 1990. They then acknowledge that there is no reported case of receptionists' actions giving out wrong information giving rise to a duty of care, but they nonetheless say that it falls within an established category. So if not by reference to some unifying principle, how is it that they have determined that this falls within an established category? And so the only way I think this should be approached is to say that the Supreme Court is saying that where you're confronted with a case which is factually different from an established category, it's not necessarily the case that it falls outside established categories. One has to look at the nature of the established category of liability for hospitals and see whether this fact pattern fits within it without further ado. And that's what they did. They said, well, here is a hospital trust, here is an A&E department. The claimant turned up, he was booked in, he reported his injury, he was in the system, he was a patient of the defendant from that time onwards, and the only question thereafter is whether what happened to him was one of something which gave rise to a reasonably foreseeable injury. And so that's the way they sidestepped, as it were, the Caparo approach, and sidestepped also any question of deciding whether the social and financial cost for the NHS was a factor to be borne in mind at all.
I suppose the difficulty I have with this, and many people might have with this, is that the job of a receptionist almost inevitably is going to be automated. I mean, when I go into my doctor's surgery, I don't talk to the receptionist at all. I just punch in my date of birth into a machine. And if that machine malfunctions in some way and gives me a very misleading idea of the waiting time, am I booked into this unified system in the same way that Darnley was, or was somehow the machine, the app, or whatever it happens to be, not being human, I haven't quite got into the system yet?
Well, the Supreme Court approach would treat that as being a set of factual questions going to breach rather than anything which served to negate a duty of care in the first place. Because what they say is that presenting yourself at the A&E department with an injury and being prepared to report it to the defendant is what's important. The second thing the Supreme Court said is that it's not really of critical significance whether you're reporting to a doctor or to a non-medical member of staff, you're reporting to the defendant. And that is the second reason why the Supreme Court found a duty of care to arise in this case. They didn't think that it was a distinction of principle that Mr. Darnley had turned up and spoken to a receptionist as opposed to turning up and speaking to anyone else in the defendant's employment, because it was up to the defendant to configure its staff and resources in whatever way it chose to meet the demands of the public. So turning to your example, if the GP surgery chooses to configure its reception services by adopting a wholly inadequate IT system which breaks down every week, then that isn't a million miles from having a receptionist who gives out the wrong information.
Yes, I suppose that's a good analogy. But let me try out another scenario on you. Say Mr. Darnley had arrived in a private car and the hospital's car park attendant had misdirected them and sent them to the wrong department, not the A&E department, and as a result he suffered his collapse in the wrong place, as happened. Would the liability cover the car park attendant?
Well, assuming the car park attendant was part of the defendant and not some private contractor running a car park in at arm's length terms from the hospital, which might, I guess, give rise to slightly different considerations. My guess is that that case would be resolved in the same way as Darnley, namely in favour of the claimant, because while the car park attendant is not there to direct the claimant to or describe to the claimant the nature of the A&E system, he is there to direct the claimant to an appropriate car parking place for the purpose of using the hospital's facilities. And if he's an A&E car park attendant, then it would be expected that he knew where A&E was. And the Supreme Court would, I think, treat the question of whether he'd done the wrong thing as a question going to breach.
So the Supreme Court dismisses the potential social cost of imposing such a duty of care. But what in reality will be the true control factors for this liability?
Well, the Supreme Court places a touching degree of faith in the negligence test itself and the factual questions of causation and so on. And it views those almost, I think maybe Lloyd-Jones even describes them as control mechanisms. They're not control mechanisms. They're not control mechanisms in the style of the Alcock psychiatric damage secondary victim control mechanisms. They're just the ordinary ingredients of the tort. They're not there to shut out liability or to prevent floodgates or to relieve massive burdens on public services. Claimants in every single kind of tort are required to surmount those hurdles, and they're not particularly difficult to do so. I guess what they might be meaning in this case is that there were a series of findings of fact by the trial judge which were, on the face of it, remarkably benign, and the Supreme Court may well be thinking, well, in another case, turning up to A&E with a head injury may not have the decisive significance that it did in this case. But their main focus is on the question of whether the hospital did the right thing. And I think the theme in this is that if a receptionist gives out information in good faith, and that information isn't flatly contradictory to the system that's in operation, as it was in this case, then there won't be a breach and therefore no liability and therefore no social and financial cost arises. But there's a degree of naivety in that, in the sense that the circumstances in which A&E departments make mistakes are not difficult to imagine, and they form the backdrop to quite detailed discussion in the Court of Appeal, which is, to my mind anyway, rather brushed aside by this judgment.
Yes, because waiting times change all the time as emergencies come into these departments.
Yes, and what about an allegation? Well, I was told it was 2 hours, but I wasn't told that 2 hours might change, which is an exact analogy to the sort of cases which you find where someone says, well, I was reassured by the hospital that my symptoms were probably benign, but I wasn't told to come back if it got worse. So yeah, they're very similar types of case, and there are certainly cases in the medical field which have succeeded on the grounds of failure to give safeguarding advice. So do receptionists have to qualify what they have to say by telling people that things change all the time in the A&E department? Do they have to issue disclaimers?
It is a more difficult question, and it And the scenario envisaged in the Court of Appeal, which is that hospitals will simply tell their receptionists that they mustn't say anything other than taking the details of the incoming patient, is quite likely to arise.
Well, it may well do. There may be circumstances in which receptionists are told that they must say something, and that those circumstances may be relatively tightly prescribed, head injuries or the like. But for the vast majority of people, they may be told that they will be seen as soon as possible or something like that, and then that they're not able to give any accurate information out on the basis that that is a safer course. Now, those worries are also, I think, slightly brushed aside. They're recited by the Supreme Court, but they don't actually address the potential consequences of A&E staff clamming up.
Indeed, and in my comparative law researches, particularly in the United States and Canada, they have a whole swathe of protections for what is called Good Samaritan activity, so that your helpful receptionist is, in that sense, a Samaritan, which in those countries would be protected by non-liability laws.
Yes, well, the Supreme Court don't really deal with the Court of Appeals approach in this case, because they found it was an established category and therefore a duty of care arose. They didn't have to decide or address directly the context in which this information is given out. It's given out in a non-medical context. It's given out to people in a particular circumstance where the information is forever changing. And effectively what the Court of Appeal was saying was that this was all a precursor to the legal relationship between patient and hospital arising, and that the information was therefore given out as a matter of courtesy, to be helpful, etc., etc., and therefore not to be visited with the consequences of a duty of care arising and potential liability and damages and so on. But they rather sidestep that on the basis that they construe the patient interaction as having started already and therefore potential liability starting already. And in a way, this case is a good illustration of particularly bad facts making bad law. It's normally said that hard cases make bad law, but or good law. But in this instance, the fact that the information that was given out was not of the sort of, oh, about 2 hours variety, and was in fact information which was obviously wrong, in a way made the Supreme Court's judgment easier, because they will say, well, you know, how often is it going to be the case that a receptionist gives out information which is just simply way over the top in terms of the length of time to be the patient will have to wait for.
So in a sense, they had a rather exceptional case, which is not going to arise again. I just want to go back to Mr. Darnley's decision to leave and not to tell any of the staff that he was leaving. So the result of the Supreme Court's decision is that this case has been remitted to the High Court for assessment of damages. Do you think that there's any likelihood that Darnley leaving the hospital will be taken into account as contributory to the hospital's negligence?
Well, I don't know. I raised this issue in my blog piece because it seemed to me that once it was found that there was a duty of care in these circumstances, I find it very difficult to see how his action of leaving the hospital could be construed as breaking the chain of causation. The Court of Appeal had found that even if they were wrong about the duty of care, the fact that he'd left meant that he was the author of his own misfortune and he should stand in law responsible for it. That is a very difficult conclusion to square with the findings that the judge made, namely that if somebody's told they're going to be having to wait for 4 to 5 hours, they may well leave the hospital, as he in fact did. Now, the judge found that had he not been told the 4 to 5 hours information, he would have stayed at least long enough for him to have been in hospital when he collapsed. So I don't see that it is absolutely clear that the fact that he left the hospital will not mean that he gets nothing. But the issue of contributory negligence is not really addressed by the Supreme Court. And I don't know, for example, whether it was raised as an alternative case by the defendant. But it is certainly something that could in principle arise because the conduct of the claimant is only said in part to have been attributable to the advice he gave. He clearly wanted to go home for some other reasons. So It's not clear to me whether contributory negligence will in fact arise on the facts of this case. The defendant may well consider that, given that the advice in part led him to leave, and that that has been decided not to give rise to any sort of novus actus in terms of breaking the chain of causation, that they may be on a losing wicket in pleading contributory negligence. I think the case falls in line with a number of recent decisions which are mentioned by Lloyd Jones in his judgments, Robinson and James Bowen, where we have a curious situation where the law of tort in the Court of Appeal seems to be under strict analysis, with quite hard analysis designed to keep the law of tort within bounds, but in the Supreme Court, a free conceptual approach which is not afraid of extending the scope of liability of public authorities on grounds which are described as being ones of principle. So we are living in interesting times in the law of tort, because I detect a somewhat of a tension between the approach that the Court of Appeal takes to these questions and that which the Supreme Court takes.
How interesting. Yes, it's almost as if the appeal court is more sensitive to the implications of broadening liability in the sphere.
Yeah, maybe because they're closer to the coalface, though not at the coalface.
Yes, indeed. Well, thank you, Owain, for your reflections on this very important ruling and its implications. And I very much hope to hear from you on LawPod UK again in the future.
Of course.
LawPod UK is presented by Rosalind English and produced by One Crown Office Row. For more editions of LawPod UK, you can subscribe to the podcast on iTunes and recommend us to a friend.